Sam Hopkinson, hi, it's Doug Fabrizio.
Hey, Doug, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, and thank you so much for being so willing to talk about this film.
Oh, sure.
I know it's not easy. Some of it is going to be difficult to talk about, but you know, we're so grateful that you're willing to give it a shot, and we're going to be so deeply, deeply respectful of not giving stuff away. I do not want to do that. It's such a pleasure to watch.
No. That's cool. I mean, to be honest, you know, I've realized it's hard for me as well because I want to talk about it.
Yeah, I know. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As you can tell, it's not easy to talk about Sam Hopkinson's film at Sundance this year, because part of the joy of the experience of seeing it is uncovering the truth. And there are these layers. And if you say too much, you're just going to ruin it. But of course, that doesn't do you any good because you haven't seen it. And why would you be interested? Well, here's why. It's a great story. A young Jewish girl whose parents were sent to a Nazi concentration camp trudges through hundreds of miles of forest to find them. And we can say enough about it that we can see why Sam was interested in it and what he managed to do with it. The film is called Misha and the Wolves. It's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance this year. We'll give you screening information here in a moment. Hopkinson joined us from his home in London. Also, I don't mind breaking the fourth wall in these interviews where you say, hold on, dude, I can't go there. So we're cool with that. So just maybe say up front, Sam, what do you figure as we talk here? What can we talk about? I think we can tell some plot elements here. I think we can carefully discuss some themes, but we're gonna stop at some point as well, right? Those are the parameters.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to make a film that was a little bit akin to peeling back layers of truth, and I wanted to make a film that put the audience right in the center of the experience that the participants in the story had as it was unfolding. As this story was unfolding, the participants experienced a lot of surprises and a lot of twists. And so that is what I wanted to echo in the film's form. So I guess forgive me if I might speak euphemistically at times, but I assure you it's because I don't want to spoil it for you.
Well, we see you winking, and that's good. So much of the pleasure of the experience in the film is bound up in the, you know, construction and deconstruction of these stories. But you're also a filmmaker who wants people to come and see it, wants to talk about it. How difficult has that been? Just the process of talking to people about it without spoiling things.
It's hard, but I'm getting used to it now.
Yeah,
I mean, I think there is, you know, they say, don't they, about all the best trailers is they're the ones that are the shortest and the ones that give least away.
Yeah.
If you watch a trailer and it tells the whole story of the film, it might not be a very good film.
You know it's a bad film if it gives stuff away. Because you know, exactly. Like, really, they're giving that thing away? You know it's going to be bad.
Exactly. And so I've got used to giving the tease, I suppose. But I mean, it's no secret that this is a story about a Holocaust memoir that turns out to be false, a hoax. That is one of the surprises of the story, but there are many more. I guess that's probably the place to start, really.
Yeah. So you're there in England. The story begins in a small town in Massachusetts. How do you hear about it? Let's talk about how you find this story and how you react to it.
Well, six years ago, I was reading a newspaper, British newspaper, and there was a tiny article about an ongoing court case that had been a bit of a bane of the Massachusetts courts, I think, for a long time, involving this memoir that had turned out to be untrue. The court case had rumbled on for a long time, and I actually researched sort of backwards in the story to the beginning of the story. And I mean, it was, I couldn't believe it was true, frankly. I mean, it just seemed like the most incredible story. And what interested me about it was the most incredible story about storytelling. And that's the first thing that drew me to it. I thought, this is a story about a story. And it's a way to explore themes of memory and history, and do it in such a way that becomes a gripping psychological thriller. I realized that here's a story that would start like an historical documentary might, but it would morph, it would change, it would surprise its audience by becoming something else, and it becomes a psychological thriller.
What is it about storytelling that interests you, at least that this is a story about a story, that the way they begin, the way they build, the way they're told, the way we want to believe them, all of those things?
All of those things. I suppose what interests me about storytelling initially is it's what I do for a living. It's what I do every day. And it struck me that what was going on in this story was very similar to what goes on in my life. It was a true story that was seized upon to make a great book. And to some extent, our film follows the publisher's journey of doing that and what happened afterwards. But I think what interests me specifically about stories and storytelling in this case is how and why we believe them to be true. I think it's fascinating how, you know, especially now in the world when truth and the notion of truth is a very slippery one, the era of fake news, it's fascinating how and why we believe a story to be true. I mean, I think I've learned a lot about it going through the journey of making this film, and it works on all sorts of different levels. But here was a story that, and when we were pitching the film, I used the analogy that grew like a virus. So it seems a bit sort of the wrong analogy to use at the moment, but it was told as any story. It was told to one person, they told it to somebody else, it spread. I think the more it spread, the more it was believed. And I find that fascinating. It's almost like if this story's been told here, and by all these people, then it must be true. It's a sort of unconscious corroboration that I think the human mind goes through. But you realize actually it's proof of nothing.
You must have been interested in the fact that we're all implicated in that, right? We all play a part in giving fuel to a story. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's, again, it's sort of a game that I play with the audience in this film. You know, and I, you know, in as I say, in an attempt to put them in the position of the participants of the story, so they experience the twists and turns as the participants experience them.
We're going to take people through part of this story in a second here, and as they'll see, it's kind of perfect. Like, it's one of those stories that seems, that's amazing. That's such a great story. And that must have been one of the things that appealed to you about it, is it's just so good.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, in a way, we're talking about two stories here. There's a story within a story. Yeah, and of course, and both of them seem so good, you know, that's the interesting thing. And this whole idea of sort of boxes within boxes and, you know, the story within the story, it really interested me.
Okay, so let's tell as much of this as we can. So this begins in Millis, Massachusetts, a small town in Massachusetts. And in the film, you ask the character Misha when it was that she first started telling this story, the first she spoke about her experiences. Here's a moment from the film.
One day, in a synagogue, on the occasion of Yom HaShoah, the Day of Remembrance, I was asked to talk about me and my story. My husband convinced me to do it, telling me it would free me. When I went up to the bima, I suddenly realized that I was going to speak for the first time. I burst into tears. And slowly, snatches, I began to tell. I was cold and I had to keep going, one step at a time. That is survival. You have to go forward, one step at a time.
And it really is, Sam, an extraordinary story. Give us some of the basics of the story that she starts to tell.
The story she tells is of her life as a young Jewish girl in Brussels, Belgium, at the start of the war. I should say at the start of the persecution of the Jews, at a time when roundups, deportations were happening, where children of Jewish families were hidden within Catholic families. They were given to Catholic families and taken on and took on Catholic identities to protect them. So they weren't deported or killed in camps. And it happened to a lot of children, not only in Brussels, obviously, all over Europe, Holland, obviously Anne Frank is a similar case that's very famous, slightly different. And Misha was hidden within a Catholic family who she didn't like and who didn't like her. And she missed her parents terribly. And she decided that she was going to strike out and find her parents. She had a little bit of knowledge from a kindly grandfather in the family that she was put in, that her parents had been taken east to Germany. She had a little compass. And she struck out on her own to walk to find her parents.
I want to play another moment from the film. It's sort of at this part of the story. In the film, we hear Misha tell this part of the story. It's told by others as well. We'll hear a woman named Jane Daniel. She'll become important to the story here in a moment. But let me play this section of the film.
At that point, Misha made a tremendous decision. It turned her whole life upside down. She decided at the age of 7, she was going to walk to Germany to find her parents. So she took her little compass and took some supplies and started heading east.
I know exactly what I need. I need the basic. I need food, something to drink, to have a knife for protection. The first night I slept below a bridge. It was not far from home. It was absolutely naive when I think about it today. On the map, Belgium seemed really small and Germany was really close. But if I went back, what would I find? Nothing was waiting for me back there. And I had the idea to find my parents, so I had to finish it.
Okay, so the story's building as you tell it in the film. Let's talk a little bit about Jane Daniel before we move on. Tell us a little bit about her, because her motives, her part in all of this is an important part of all of this.
Jane was one of the first people I spoke to when I heard about the story. Seemed to me that she was central to it. She was the one who found the story and ultimately was the one who turned detective to find out quite if Misha's story was true or not. I saw in her something that I do every day, in the sense that she was a small-time publisher who was looking you know, who had her eye out for a great story. And she attended one of Misha's local talks. She heard what Misha had to say, and she approached Misha and said, I'd very much like to make a book out of your story. And as our conversation evolves, I think you'll understand that she is, I suppose, a co-protagonist in this story with Misha. And they end up falling out. A huge court case ensued. There were very large questions posed about whether she was, in a sense, exploiting a Holocaust survivor. And to some extent, after the trial, she needed to fight to clear her name.
One of the things that the film does really well is it asks these really candid questions about motive. And really, as we were saying before, it implicates all of us in that question. But how about Jane? How honest was she with you about her interests and her motive? I mean, there are moments here in the film where I'm like, yeah, she's being pretty upfront about it. But then there are also moments where you do wonder about all of that. Just how do you describe your relationship with her and the way she plays the role in the film?
I found her very honest with me in many ways. I mean, she was very, you know, I think she can be criticized. You know, she lost a court case, and a huge financial judgment was put up against her. There were claims of financial irregularities in that court case, and she didn't shy away from talking about them in many ways. So I found her honest. I found her a storyteller, to be honest. Yeah. I really found her a storyteller.
Right? Which exactly what you
I,
mean.
I found her a storyteller. Yeah. And I mean, I put it to her in the interview, actually, that, you know, there's an irony here that she went in looking for she went in because she thought she'd found a great story. And years later, she came out with a completely different, but probably even better story.
So Jane sees obviously a potential in this story. And she says she figured she could take her very small publishing company and bring it into the big time. So as the story plays out, she has to convince Misha to write all of this down, to write a book. Here's another moment from the film. At first, Misha is unsure about all of this.
With everything I went through, I'd learned to mistrust people.
I don't think she was terribly impressed with me, and there was no reason she should be. The kind of book that I had published before, it was a legal financial book, not exactly her kind of thing.
For more than 2 years, I refused. But my community and my friends said to me, Misha, do it. For future generations. I found myself in hell again.
It was a painful process, but it was as if she was compelled to tell her story, as if it was some kind of a catharsis.
Sam, that moment where she says, Misha, do it. How important is this part to the way the story then plays out? Like that decision then to make it more public, to kind of cross over a line. It seems like this is kind of a critical point.
It is. It is absolutely a critical point in the plot of the story. And it's a critical point in the lives, I think, of both Misha and Jane. There is a difference between a story being local, I suppose, a local folk tale or something. The media getting hold of a story. And it was at that moment that happened. And it became, and I think we should mention just a step back, one of the reasons why Jane realized that this story was publishing gold was it had this incredible twist.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story, but this is what makes it gold, right? All right, here's another moment from the film. This is Misha talking about this amazing twist.
I turn around and I see this magnificent animal. To me, it was like a huge dog. The wolf seemed alone, and I needed a companion. It was a beautiful gray she-wolf. I look in my bag for something to eat, and I give a piece to the wolf, and she doesn't take. It takes a lot of time, but after a while, we would walk in parallel. I was able to see its generosity, to appreciate the strength it had. I was able to live with it. She was like a mother to me. Much later, it was a whole pack of wolves. I don't know how long I was with them. It accepted me and protected me.
That's the twist. And that is amazing. Talk a little bit about that, because it's this part, right, of the story that really is when the story blows up and when it takes off.
Absolutely. And, you know, why wouldn't you think so? I mean, it's, you know, there are all sorts of stories, of course, of, you know, folk tales, fairy tales, children raised by wolves. This isn't a child raised by wolves. This is a child experiencing wolves lost alone in the forests of Central Europe, you know, but yet it was something that obviously would chime with all those fairy tales, folk tales, and it's the thing that made the story different from all the other Holocaust memoir stories, I suppose, and exactly what Jane jumped on.
That's Sam Hopkinson. His film is Misha and the Wolves. It's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance this year. For information about how to watch it or others in the festival, go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
The Utah legislative session is always 45 days long, and this year's session is shaping up to be extra weird due to the pandemic. I'm Sonia Hudson, politics reporter at KUER.
And I'm Emily Means, another politics reporter at KUER. We're the hosts of the podcast 45 Days, guiding you through the most important political issues of the week.
Subscribe to 45 Days for free wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Misha De Fonseca's memoir had all of the makings of a Hollywood blockbuster. A young Jewish girl escapes Nazi persecution by fleeing into the woods and, for a time, lives among a pack of wolves. Sam Hopkinson's documentary at Sundance this year is about the story, though it's kind of about the story behind the story, which we are not going to spoil. We can say Hopkinson is trying to put viewers in what he describes as that uneasy space between truth and fiction. Really, what he's interested in is why we believe the stories we're told. The film is called Misha and the Wolves. Talk about the reaction, because this story really takes off. Disney gets interested, and
It does. It's, you know, I think, you know, I should say that Jane, you know, she went to a local wolf sanctuary, spoke to them, said, could this be true? Misha got very friendly with the people at the wolf sanctuary, and they saw a woman who had an amazing affinity with animals.
Yeah.
You know, they were completely surprised. Jane moves forward with the story, and all of a sudden her agent's coming back from LA saying, Disney want this. Oprah Winfrey at the time had her book club. They wanted, you know, they wanted to do a show. And all of a sudden, this small-time publisher has a hit on her hands.
You mentioned Misha's connection to wolves, which I have to say gives another dimension to this story that I hadn't expected. I mean, so there's this woman who lives not far from Misha. You mentioned that wolf sanctuary. Her name's Joni Sofren. And she and Misha become friends. And Joni sees, as you said, that connection between Misha and these wolves. It's like she belonged with these wolves. And there's this great story in the film. I wanted to play a section from it. When the producers for the Oprah Winfrey Show, they've come out to film Misha with some of Joni's wolves. Set us up for this story, because the thing that happens is kind of cool, kind of amazing.
Yeah, amazing. Exactly as you said. The way it worked with Oprah was that they would come out and shoot a film sequence that they would play in, and then they would meet the participants in the studio afterwards. They knew, or they learned, the Oprah producers, that Misha was a regular at this wolf sanctuary, Wolf Hollow. And they asked Joni Sofren, who ran Wolf Hollow, if they wouldn't mind coming to film that segment with Misha at Wolf Hollow. Filming starts and everything's going swimmingly well. Misha goes into the pen with the wolves and she's feeding them. She stands up. All of a sudden, this huge wolf, huge male wolf, stands up, puts its paws on her shoulders, and very slowly takes her head in its mouth, its huge jaws. Obviously, everybody who's there, Jane Daniel, the Oprah people, Joni Sofren, their hearts are in their mouths.
And at that point, Misha rears back, lets out a big howl. I get goosebumps telling this story. And from the back, way back in the back of the pen, we hear an owl coming back.
When she howled, they immediately howled back.
There it was. You could see. There's the connection between the human and the wolf. I saw it. You know, it was amazing. It was a shocking moment. So they had got a lot of really interesting wolf footage, and I thought, this is going to make a great Oprah show.
Say something about this other dimension, about the relationship she has with these wolves. It's really, I don't know, this complicates things.
Yeah, this woman had an incredible affinity, has an incredible affinity with animals. Yeah. She feeds wild animals at her home. She has numerous pets. They are, for her, more honorable than human beings. She would tell you, you know, where a human being will deceive you, an animal never will. She believes that, you know, her closeness with wolves as a child in the forest, albeit briefly, was a way to touch a sort of moral goodness, I suppose, at a time in the world where morals were badly wrong and adult human beings were at war with each other, a sort of innocence. What the story you just heard there in that episode at Wolf Hollow is, I suppose, a good example of her affinity with animals.
Yeah. The story, of course, as you mentioned, it begins to turn. Misha and Jane's relationship sours. There's this lawsuit that you work through in the film. And it goes to trial. And as you were saying before, it's, you know, this question comes up about exploiting someone who's been through the hell and horror of the Holocaust. And it raises that larger question of believing someone who had talked about their experience in the Holocaust. It's one of those themes in the film, and the sympathy that we give to them. It's another moment in the film I wanted to play. It's from this trial section. Misha, of course, was a very sympathetic figure. And in this moment, we'll hear Ramona Hamlin. She's Misha's attorney, along with Misha and again, Jane Daniel.
The jury was riveted. In front of you is a person who survived the Holocaust as a child and written a memoir about it. They were engaged and absolutely enthralled by this story. Misha was a good witness.
All what I live is under manuscript, because it's my life.
It just made me look like a monster. And I thought, this is not going well.
Talk about this theme, if you would, this idea of, because this is, it's almost like sacrosanct territory. You can't, when the Holocaust is involved, it gives another layer to a story.
Exactly. And that's it's a massive theme of the film, really, is the, you know, I suppose history has certain sacred cows. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Misha was claiming to be a Holocaust survivor made it very difficult to question her all the way along. And it's probably one of the reasons why her story was so ultimately so successful. I mean, I should add that the trial was not, obviously, Jane didn't stand accused of taking advantage of a Holocaust survivor. It wasn't that simple. I mean, she stood accused of misuse of the copyright, of withholding royalties from Misha. And there were undoubtedly financial irregularities involved. But what's fascinating is that the jury and everybody in that courtroom knew the situation. Here was a Holocaust survivor. Here was a publisher. I find that interesting, that it's, you know, it's interesting to know whether true justice can be done in that situation. You know, where obviously Misha is eliciting a huge amount of sympathy. I mean, it has to be said, and in fairness to the judge, the judge would not allow Misha to tell her story in court. She would not allow her attorney to tell her story in court. It wasn't about that. This was a contract dispute, ultimately. But, of course, the jury knew who the parties were.
Well, and it's difficult to raise questions about the story. And you've talked a little bit about sort of this whole genre of the postmodern Holocaust story, where you mentioned the Holocaust survivor sort of becomes the star of this, and the story itself, I think you've described it as kind of a commodity.
Yeah. What's interesting is when I started to make this film, I wasn't in the market to make a Holocaust documentary. I mean, it wasn't what I wanted to do. I became interested in this because it was a story about storytelling, about memory, history, and the truth, I suppose. But I realized as time went on that I was making a Holocaust documentary, but I was making a different kind of Holocaust documentary, a postmodern Holocaust documentary that's less about the actual events themselves than about the shadow they have cast, the cultural shadow they've cast. The documentary films, the journalistic articles, the Holocaust memoirs, this whole genre. As you say, with, you know, that has at the heart of it the sort of Holocaust survivor as star and their story as commodity. It's fascinating to look at. I don't mean to criticize it, say it's right or wrong one way or another, but I sort of realized as I was doing this that this, you know, this world exists, and it's a slightly dangerous world, and one that you have to navigate as, you know, as a storyteller, and as a also, as I guess, as a Holocaust survivor, you have to navigate it in a way that keeps your dignity intact. Another aspect, another facet of this industry, I suppose, is that the whole industry of concentration camp tourism, that kind of thing. And, you know, the whole idea that, you know, there's money to be made to draw people to see these places and experience them. They should be seen. They should be experienced. But how that's managed so it becomes a solemn experience, an experience for reflection, remembrance, and understanding, rather than an opportunity for an Instagram selfie, is a very difficult one.
It's not the first time that in your work you've explored, you know, these questions of truth and what's real. I'm thinking of Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable, which is, we don't need to go into the particulars of that. It's just the story of this art found beneath the depths of the ocean and the shipwreck and the questions around it. And it's really fascinating, by the way, for people who haven't seen it. It involves Damien Hirst. But I wanted to talk about the devices that you use, and without giving too much away here, the decisions that you were having about, you know, the storytelling devices that you want.
The storytelling devices, the form of the film. It's really important for me that the film took on a form that placed the audience right in the heart of the story, of the experience that the participants in the story went through. So I wanted it to be like sort of peeling back of layers of truth. And I didn't want to play my hand at the beginning, you know, play my whole hand at the beginning. I think it's a, you know, I wanted to treat it like you would treat a scripted thriller. And the experience of the story was important to me. So we found, I suppose, devices in the way we shot the film to do that, you know. And these range, there are different devices, you know. The film opens in a way like a conventional history documentary. And in a way, the devices I'm employing at the beginning are pretty similar to the ones I might deploy at that point. You know, there's an element of recreation. We have a sense of a young girl walking through the woods. You know, I mean, that's something that I suppose that the decision to use that sort of strand of recreation was a lot to do with creating the feel of an historical documentary. Later on, the film then becomes more like a psychological thriller, and we're, all of a sudden we're employing slightly different devices there. And you know, as this, everything with this film, there's boxes within boxes and devices within devices that are revealed to the audience as the story unfolds.
Good job. I think you did a good job that, well, not really too much. I did wonder about are there other films, whether narrative or documentary films, that you called on as kind of references for what you wanted to accomplish?
There were references, absolutely. A documentary called The Imposter, made by Bart Layton, that was an influence. A documentary, a wonderful documentary called Stories We Tell by a Canadian filmmaker called Sarah Polley, about family secrets. It's an amazing film that had strong influence on this. So there were documentaries that had an influence, and I suppose they were the main ones.
When there's a great story, That's one of the things that I found about this film. When there's a great story, everyone wants in on it. And not just in, you know, the financial cut that people are looking for. Some just want to believe. But then there are the storytellers who want in on this story, like people in radio, like, you know, like me, like filmmakers, like you. And that's one of the things about the film that's so interesting is in some ways there's a kind of, I think you've described it as a self-referential part of it, like being honest about the fact that you want a cut in this story as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, am I just doing what Jane was doing in the first place? You know, piggybacking on an amazing tale. I hope I'm doing it because, but I think the compulsion to tell stories, we shouldn't be shy about that, I suppose. It's very human to want to tell stories. And undoubtedly, I approached the film in a way, I hope, when the audience sort of comes out of it, understands that I've been honest about the fact that we have sort of become another link in the chain, if you see what I mean, of the telling of this.
Yeah.
You know, and that was quite important to me. It was important to me to remain neutral in terms of the characters. You know, I didn't set out to bring anybody down with this film. You know, that's really important. I mean, there will be strong feelings towards everybody involved, but I wanted, again, the audience to leave the cinema and make their own minds up and argue about it. You know, and it's interesting that it was a very hard film. Well, I suppose I should first say that, you know, what's so fascinating about the story is all the characters have very complex and very human motivations. And they're not simple. They're very three-dimensional. And that's what you seek in a good story. And as the story evolves, I suppose I wanted to put the viewer in a position where they continually sort of reassess the shifting truth within the story, and the one that would provoke, you know, debate about the motivations of its characters, you know, and to some extent to trap the viewer in the same moral maze as the film's characters. So when they are thinking, am I for that person or am I for that person? And maybe their allegiances shift during the story. Mm-hmm. And they're my favorite kind of films, really, where you're not quite sure, you know, are you a hero or a villain? I'm not quite sure, you know, and then at the end, they can leave the cinema and argue about it. And I think that was important to me. And for that reason, actually, it was a very hard film to finish. It was very hard to find a note to finish on because I didn't really want to give anybody the last word. Or I was very concerned about who should have the last word because there's a lot of animosity and, you know, still in this. And, you know, it seemed unfair to give any of the sort of warring factions, as it were, the last word. But there was, in the process of making the film, we discovered this wonderful character called Evelyn Handel, was herself a hidden child during the war and is a genealogist, researcher, who was involved in the search to find the truth behind Misha's story.
Yeah. She's one of those citizen detectives, I think you described her. And
it's amazing, but, you know, with her own story.
For sure, Well, it seems like to me that, Sam, she becomes kind of the moral center to the story because she's the only one who's – I think you described it this way. She's unencumbered by an ulterior motive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's very few people in this story who are. There are others. But she So it seemed right, given that she herself had gone through what Misha had claimed to have gone through. It seemed right for her to be given the last word, really, in the story. And what's interesting is, and we found this out quite late in the editing of the film, actually, the sort of the way to do this. But there's a moment where I ask Evelyn what she feels about Misha now. And it's very telling. I mean, she goes through it within the film. She goes through a journey of, you know, feeling incredibly hurt by what Misha has done. And when she finds out more about Misha's actual story and her, you know, interesting sort of potential motivations behind all of this, she to some extent changes her tune. But when faced with the question, what do you feel about Misha now, she finds it very hard to articulate herself. And this is an articulate woman, and to me that was telling, because that's what I feel ultimately. I feel it's hard to articulate how I feel about Misha. Mm-hmm. And
why? Because it's the what are the depths and boundaries of my sense of empathy?
Yeah, I guess it's a, you know, torn between being sort of disgusted and sympathetic, you know, which but the way Evelyn expresses herself and searches for her words and then almost censors her own words at the end is for me, you know, for me sums it up. So we sort of alighted on that as being essentially the end of the film, and a thought for people to sort of go away with.
Evelyn says it's human to believe.
She does. She does. And I believe that as well. I think it's really interesting how we want stories to be true, I think. You know, and I read this book by Malcolm Gladwell called Talking to Strangers. And in that he has this whole section about how human beings default to truth, as the social scientists who've done the experiments have realized. We you know, it's natural to assume something is true. And actually the person who's a skeptic is an outlier. They're the person who is different. And the interesting thing is the theory behind this is that we sort of need to default to truth for society to work, for compassion to work. You know, how, where does sympathy lie if you're skeptical about everything everyone's telling you? Where does charity lie if you're skeptical about everything everyone's telling you? So, you know, I think that's fascinating. The aspect of human behavior, you know, whether we like it or not.
Sam Hopkinson, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Doug. It was great to chat.
Sam Hopkinson. His film Misha and the Wolves is in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance this year, which is now underway. If you want information about how to watch it or others from the festival, go to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you, or on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.